Accession number 19914, Reel 3.
Colonel Henderson, Reel 3. Can I take you through the Malayan emergency, please? What job did you have with the battalion then?
By this time, I was regimental signal officer. So I was a member of battalion headquarters. And so my war in Malaya was different to the war I had experienced in Korea, where I was a platoon commander. As signal officer, you're one of the staff officers to the commanding officer, and one's life is in tactical headquarters, and the companies, of course, are forward in the jungle, and my responsibility was to make sure that communications existed between them and tactical headquarters.
What were the main problems of doing your job then?
Well, in 1955, radio communications were actually, compared with today, pretty basic. And we depended upon skywave aerials for our high-frequency radio sets. And we passed our messages between companies and TAC headquarters by day, by voice. But this was not easy to read because of the amazing amount of muck you get in the signals on the radio sets. And by night, of course, it was transferred between companies and tactical headquarters by Morse. So the difference between then and now, and this is only, we're only talking about, 45 years, in radio communications is profound. Whereas today they are absolutely excellent and easy to communicate. 45 years ago, they were jolly difficult.
Why voice in the day and Morse at night?
Voice was better by day and very difficult at night. Morse could be read at night.
You mean because of reception being
poor? Because of reception.
Why should reception have been poorer at night?
I think there's just more problems at night from the fact that it is nighttime, and that is why Morse is used at that time of day.
You mean more physical problems?
No, more, you used the word a second ago, and I can't find it. Reception. Reception was very much more difficult at night, and therefore you use Morse to pass messages between companies and tactical headquarters. And that was my responsibility, to make sure that these messages could be passed back and forwards as signal officer. But for me, that was a different war to the war I had had in Korea.
So did you ever go out into the jungle?
Yes, I did, but only for very brief periods, to either see signalers who were belonged to me in the signal platoon, but were what were known as rear links from companies back to battalion headquarters. But as far as actually living in the jungle and patrolling in the jungle, no, I did not have to do that during the Malayan War.
I think later in your career you were served in Borneo.
That's true, yes. Now this happened in 1965. And at that time we were stationed in Shorncliffe in Kent, and the confrontation was taking place in Borneo, in Sarawak, which was a British protectorate, and Kalimantan, which is the part of the island of Borneo, which belongs to Indonesia. And the Kalimantans were trying to infiltrate into Sarawak to take over that protectorate, and the British government at the time decided that this should not happen, and the British army was sent to Sarawak to prevent the infiltration into Sarawak. As I said, we were stationed in Shorncliffe at that time, and we were sent out on a year's tour to Borneo, Sarawak. This was preceded by a 3-month stint in Hong Kong, So we flew to Hong Kong from the United Kingdom and spent 3 months in Hong Kong at a time of year which was called the Double Tenth, 10th of October, when riots were expected, and we were sent to Hong Kong to cover that period. Now, in fact, the riots did not take place, and shortly after the 10th of October had passed, we were moved down to Sarawak. In fact, we went to Singapore first, and from Singapore, we were transferred by boat to the Rejang River, and we took a boat up this massive great river into the center of Sarawak. It is navigable by very large ocean-going ships for 300 miles, and when the boat was no longer able to go any further up the Rejang, we were taken out of this large ship and then placed into smaller craft, and we moved into Sarawak proper. The town headquarters was at a place called Cebu, and the four rifle companies were upcountry near the frontier between Sarawak and Kalimantan. At this time I was commanding A Company of the 1st Battalion KOSB, and we went well into Sarawak up a river called the Song River. And there I had one platoon at company headquarters and two platoons further up, practically on the frontier between Kalimantan and Sarawak. I found this the most a most interesting year in my career as far as soldiering is concerned, because Sarawak is a quite different country to any country in which I had served before. It was a country which is largely untouched, this is back now nearly 34 years ago, untouched by Western civilization, and one lived amongst a most interesting people, the Ibans, who lived on the rivers and hills off Sarawak. And we were stationed very near a river, the Song River, as I have just mentioned. And from there, the platoons in my company, and indeed the other companies within the battalion, were sent out to patrol the frontier between Sarawak and Kalimantan, and where possible, ambush the Indonesians who were trying to get into Sarawak. And Sarawak is a rather beautiful country. It is a country of primary jungle and deep, fast-flowing rivers. The frontier between Sarawak and Kalimantan is a ridge on one side, that is on the eastern side you have Kalimantan, on the western side you have Sarawak. And from this ridge, great rivers flow down in very mountainous, jungly country. And it was there that we served for a year. And it was just an interesting and fun place to be as far as soldiering was concerned. It is a massive country, and finding the Indonesians was not at all easy. We were reasonably successful in our quest. I don't think a huge number of Indonesians crossed in our particular area of Sarawak, but nevertheless one had to be very aware of what was going on, and I think the soldiers enjoyed it greatly. And I would just like to say that that was a most interesting year in my life, soldiering with my battalion and my regiment.
What were these infiltrators supposed to be doing once they crossed the border?
They were sent into Sarawak in the hope of upsetting the government of Sarawak and taking it over, because those in Kalimantan, that is Indonesia, believed that Sarawak should belong to Indonesia. In fact, it has been a British protectorate ever since the days of Raja Brooke, who ruled it for getting on for 100 years, from about 1840 until it was made a protectorate in 1940. That is what the Kalimantans were trying to do, to take it over from a British protection ship.
But if they were just wandering around in the jungle, they could hardly disrupt the government.
Well, of course, they hoped to come over in large enough numbers to upset the ruling power, which was Britain at that time.
Did you What, did you take part in any ambushes yourself?
Personally, no. But the platoons of which were in my company did. Some were successful, some were not, because we served in what was known as 4 Division in Sarawak, and it was a massive division, and therefore the British troops in that area were very much more sparsely laid out than they were, for instance, further to the south in Sarawak, where there was a very narrow space between Kalimantan and the seaboard, and there it was easier for them to come over, and they came over in greater numbers further south to us. In our area, very large, very difficult to find.
So what were the main problems that you had to cope with as a company commander?
The maintenance of the platoons once they were out in their area and getting those platoons into their ambush positions on the various tracks from Kalimantan into Sarawak, which, as I've mentioned, was primary jungle. And in order to get them into these, cover these very large distances, 40, 50 miles, one used helicopters. And in Sarawak, you either moved on your feet, extremely slow and not easy, or you moved by boat, which of course had limited access to the various parts, or you came in on helicopters, from which you lured yourself out of the helicopters, or abseiled out of the helicopters, into sites in the jungle. You then cleared spaces so that helicopters coming in later with supplies could land on these LZs, landing zones, and then from there you spread out and existed in ambush positions on the ridges, on the tracks passing from Kalimantan into Sarawak in the hope of catching the Indonesians coming over.
What was the caliber, soldierly caliber, of the people you were fighting against?
I think they were dedicated to what they were trying to do, and I think they were efficient. They knew how to work in jungle. They were difficult to find, and we, of course, had the assistance of the Ibans in Sarawak, who supported what we were trying to do, which was to maintain the British protectorate of Sarawak, and they acted as our guides and our trackers. Whereas the Kalimantans, the people from Indonesia, were jungle people themselves and they knew how to get around. But we had the help of those people in Sarawak who acted as our guides and our trackers.
Any memories of the Ibans you can put on to?
Yes.
How they lived?
Yeah, the Ibans are most charming people. And I'm glad you asked me that question, because it's fundamental to the year I had in Sarawak and how much I enjoyed it. They live in longhouses on the river, and their social life is the form of social life which is quite alien to we who live in this country. In other words, we talk in this country nowadays of building more and more and more and more houses. I believe some huge number by the year 2010, because so many people in this country want to live alone in houses. Now, the Ibans live in long houses, and there they have the most amazing social arrangement whereby the families live together in the long houses, so that you have all the working people working, you have all the children together, and perhaps most importantly of all, you have all the grandmothers and the grandfathers being looked after by their own families in these amazing longhouses. And I have many memories of being entertained by them, by the Penghulu, which was the name given to the head man, the head Iban, who ruled the longhouse. And they used to have us along to their longhouses to entertain us by day and indeed in the evenings. And these were wonderful memories, because we used to take our company pipers along with us, and the piper would play his bagpipes on the longhouse veranda, which might stretch for nearly 100 yards. And the Ibans are great dancers, and they loved watching our own country dancer dancing for them, and then they in turn would carry out their Iban dances for us and would entertain us royally. And it just seemed to me to be such an amazing way of life, which is quite alien to ours, when we, as families, seem to split up, and grandmothers and grandparents become an absolute strain upon many families, whereas here was a native jungle people sharing exactly how it could be done. I understand, sadly, that since we left Sarawak and it became part of Malaya, that the Malayan government have allowed the Japanese hardwood firms to come in and cut down masses of primary jungle, and many of the Ibans in their longhouses have been uplifted and turfed out and given, in inverted commas, dreadful concrete buildings in which to live, and it must be totally alien to their way of life. There is one other thing that might interest you. On a patrol I did go on in Sarawak, I met a most interesting Scotsman called John Wilson, who ran. He was a most interesting man. He'd been a bomber pilot during the war, and he'd taken part in the bombing of Dresden. And he felt that he had taken so much out of life by destroying the city that he wanted to put something back into it. And after the war, he left Britain and went to Sarawak. He was a school teacher by trade, by profession, and he went out to teach the Iban children mathematics, English, or whatever. But he also produced communities in Sarawak whereby he taught them how to run their agriculture in a more economic fashion. What the Ibans do is they cut and burn and then plant and move on and cut and burn and plant. And it produces secondary jungle out of what originally had been primary jungle, but it's not an economic way to carry out agriculture. And John Wilson taught these people how to carry out sensible cultivation. At the same time, he taught the Iban children the basics of mathematics, English, and most interestingly enough, he adopted two Iban boys. He was an unmarried man, and out of his own pocket, he sent these two clever young Ibans back to Scotland, where they were educated at Nairn Academy near Inverness, and having been educated, they were then brought back to Sarawak, where their adoptee father, i.e. John Wilson, sent these two boys out to look after two other communities, so that you had John Wilson and his two adopted sons looking after other communities, which they turned into the same sort of communities as he has run. And one of the most memorable evenings of my life, I think, was sitting with John Wilson in his beautiful longhouse, which he and his Ibans had built for him, listening to little Iban children dancing to Scottish country dances on a gramophone which he had produced with, eights and reels and Duke of Perths and dances like that, to see the little Iban children doing that in his house. That is a story. I actually wrote an article in, I think, called The Scots Magazine about that. But this is why I enjoyed Sarawak so much.
Did you ever go back to the rubber estate from which you came?
I've never been back to Sumatra, no. It is something that my sister often talk about, but I have not been back.